This isn't an interactive talk, guys. Isn't it nice to see that Bill isn't pissed anymore?
You think of something.
I realize now how they decided to kill the flies. They just sucked all the oxygen out the room because there ain't none up here right now. And I figured it would be somebody real sharp. Hey, Larry, I'll call you. I figured it would be somebody in the back that would yell, you know, stand up. Thanks, Larry. But it was one of the cooks who shared that. I want to thank the committee and Bill for calling. And of course, when they called and asked me, I was like automatically, yes, I'll do it. And then I hung up, and then it was just like started freaking out and was real scared. And I called my sponsor, and he did what all good sponsors do. You know, he laughed at me, you know. It wasn't that funny. So finally he came over, because see, this is where I got sober. This is a big deal to me. This is where I got sober. And my sponsor came over to visit me the other day to go through this, and I told him, I said, man, you know, I've heard Noel B, who just set me on fire, changed my life, and Father Ed just changed my life, and all the people who have talked up here, and he said, so they asked you to be one of them? I said, no, and he said, well, forget all that. We need to talk about something really important right now. And I said, man, what's up? He said, where are we going to have lunch? See, y'all went to the same sponsorship school. I wear a tie. The people in our sponsorship tree wear a tie. And a little bit behind that is we're not special. We're not different. It's just what we do. And I work for the railroad, and I used to stay on camp cars and travel quite a lot. And I remember I spoke one Thursday night about 2 hours from Roanoke, and I called my sponsor, a different sponsor, and whined to him, and you know what he did? He laughed at me. And I said, you know, I don't have any of my boys with me, and you're not with me, and what am I going to do? He said, you know, you're going to give your talk and get in the car and come home, blah, blah, blah. So I went in and sat in the front row and got up to talk. And about 5 minutes after 8, Robbie D., Michael D., and Mozan, two and a half hours one way on a work night, walked into that meeting with suits on and sat on the front row. And see, that's a big deal to me. So I'm pretty scared. And for what we do, when we get real scared, I go to the book. And I need to find out what my answers are. And there is a solution, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. And then I go to when therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there's nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which we have not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. And because of y'all, that's happened in my life. So let's do the deal. My name's JP, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Now, it's only by God's grace the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is taught to me from a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Good sponsorship and active participation in the home group. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since November 28th, 1988. And there's a whole lot of people in my neighborhood that are happy about that. You know, and I always get tickled, you know. People say, well, you know, these aren't necessarily going to be the views of AA. They're just my opinions. Well, I certainly hope I reflect some things about Alcoholics Anonymous, or, you know, people in my home group are going to be upset. But a lot of things I heard here, you know, and I remember Jimmy S. in my very first workshop. He said, you can lie if you want to, you can cheat if you want to, you can steal if you want to. But the good news is you don't have to anymore. And that freed me up. And so you're not going to hear anything new from me today. You're going to hear stuff that you've heard at this workshop. This is my 20th workshop. And you're going to hear the same things that I was taught here, I hope. And I started drinking. I heard a guy speak here one time. And he said, I believe that, when I was born, I was born an alcoholic. And when I took my first drink, I became a drunkard. And from the day I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to live life one day at a time, as just a regular alcoholic. And that's me. I know that's me. You know, and I love to hear guys up here talk a lot. And I hear great speakers here who open up with great jokes. And I was trying to think of a joke. And, you know, real life is always funnier than a joke. You know, I'm a 42-year-old Irish-Polish alcoholic. Joke's on me. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, it's real funny. Thank you. Well, he's in the story too, so just hold on. I started drinking when I was 12 years old. Took my first drink of a bunch of us boys were up at Smith Mountain Lake, and I wasn't as little as I am now, maybe, and they're a bunch of big old boys. And we snuck off and got a bunch of beer, and I always get tickled too. I love to hear people talk that know all their dates. You know, boom, boom, boom. They know all their dates. You know, that ain't happening here today, guys. Because I'm going to tell you right now. You know, I was going to get promoted, and I went on a job interview 5 years ago. And Cindy, you know, Cindy was talking to me. And she said, "Now, baby, don't babble." She said, "You know how you are when you get scared. You just babble." I said, "All right, baby." I said, "Thank you. I'll try." And you know, during the dinner, the guy that was interviewing me, he started off with the really, really hard questions, you know. "How old are you?" I told him, you know, I went from 34, and then I went back to 36, and I came back to 35, and he was just like looking at me. You know, like, what, you know? And I could see Cindy. It was too late. It already started. And I was afraid of real hard questions like, you know, what's your phone number and where do you live? But see, that's the same girl, you know, that I called this morning and that I talk with every time before I share someplace. See, that's the same girl that 2 weeks before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I came out of a raging blackout and I had both my hands wrapped around her neck because I beat her head against our refrigerator door. And my 6-year-old son had a knife and a pair of scissors and was trying to cut me off his mama. See, I'm not proud of that, but see, that's what brought me to this dance. That's what brought me here. And you know, I got to tell you this. So on the phone this morning, you know, I was whining to her, and I don't know if Jewel is in here or not, but she said, right before I got off the phone, she said, "Hey, Jewel," she said, she said, "You know, just be real careful about one thing." And I said, "What's that?" She goes, "You're really ugly when you cry." My jaw open. I just couldn't believe it because when I go home, I tell her about all y'all, you know, from the very first time. And I just, that's not that funny, baby. We were those boys to the lake and we had a bunch of Budweiser and we started drinking. And, you know, a bunch of those boys, we had some liquor. I didn't drink any liquor. I was just drinking the beer and they'd blow bubbles into it and they were acting like they were drinking and I was drinking. I liked it right off. You know, I was just slamming them back and going, and you know, and I love it when people say, you know, "I remember my first blackout." What's up with that? I mean, you don't remember them. But that did happen to me, you know, and I remember I threw up and blacked out, and the very next day, when I woke up in that trailer, it was like, you know, that's a pretty cool deal. You know, it was a pretty cool deal. And I'm a firm believer, too, that the disease of alcoholism will steal my dreams. It'll take every single dream that I ever had. My dream at my early on in my life was I wanted to be a theater and I wanted to be an actor. Not a movie star, but a working actor on Broadway. And I tried to work at that craft. I tried in school to be in plays and to do all those things. And I took it very, very seriously. And I'll tell you today that I'm sitting in a room full of people who I know also had their dreams, but they were taken away and not able to realize those dreams because of the disease of alcoholism. And that's a big deal. And so going through my life, I could always do whatever I wanted to do through school. I drank all through school. You know, I drank. And that's what a bunch of us did. I could hang out with the white rich kids. I could hang out with the poor white kids. I could hang out with the black kids. I could hang out with the jocks. I could hang out with the smart people. Not for a long time. But I could hang out with, I know, they catch on real quick. But, you know, and I remember with my sponsor, you know, I told him I was a people pleaser. And he said, "Let's get this straight right now." He said, "You're not a people pleaser." He said, "You're a liar and a con." I said, "But doesn't people pleaser sound a lot better?" Told him I was a perfectionist. He said, "Perfectionists don't get fired from their jobs." So we deleted those from my vocabulary, and that was doing the deal, and was drinking, and I remember my brother and I, we flipped a Pinto one time, 235 feet, and all the glass was busted out of it, and they found our shoes in the back seat, you know, and we kept drinking. I went through the windshield. I hit a 62 Park Dodge one time, same Pinto, and I went through the windshield, cut my ear almost all the way off, 100 and some stitches in the side of my face, and kept drinking. You know, it just didn't mean anything. You know, that's just what we do. We drink. So got out of high school and went to a small junior. I don't know if any of y'all are familiar with Virginia, but went to a small junior college called Ferrin, Virginia. And, hey, good. It's a shame you know that place. but started doing theater work. And we wrote our own TIEs, Theater and Educations, and we did shows in inner city Harlem, Central Park, New York City, up and down the East Coast. And for 2 weeks, I was a paid actor. And I had realized my dream. And we do 8 shows a day. And we'd go into PS, we're up 541. And, you know, and I'm just a kid. And I remember then they had, we'd go in teacher's lounges, and it would be 10 questions, are you an alcoholic? And my buddy would say, me now, hey, come here, we want you to take a test. So, okay. And, you know, we go, yes, 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 you know, all 10, poof, right down the line. And everybody would do what y'all just did. Everybody would laugh, and I'd laugh. But you know what, inside, at 18-year-olds, I wasn't laughing. I knew I was a drunkard. I worked the first step way before I ever got here. I knew I was a daily blackout drinker from 1976 to 1988 when I got sober. That makes me no better or no worse than anybody else in this room. That's just my deal. You know, and that's all I have is my story, so that's what I got to tell. And went through that, and the thing about Ferrum is, in the summertime, they hire 15 men, kids, boys, whatever I was, and 15 girls. And they put you all on the same floor, and you work there. You just work there. So I went down the dumpster and got a sofa. That's where I did most of my shopping. And brought it up to the room and started having keg parties and stuff. And you live there and you work and they pay you. And it was just crazy all the time. I mean, just all the time. But the thing that happened was I met a girl there. And that was a girl who was to become Cindy. And well, she was already Cindy, but she became my wife. I'll calm down in a minute. And we got hooked up. She was from Salisbury, North Carolina. I was living in working in Ferrum, and I met her, and it was just, man, she was pretty, you know. She was really pretty, and I mean really pretty. And she didn't have much to do with me right then, but I left that school. They asked me to leave, and you know, when they do that, you got to go. So I went down to the house restaurant, little bar. The guy hired me. His name was Bernie. And he said, you can drink while you work. Just keep track of what you drink while you're working. Still haven't received a check from old Bernie. Oh, we didn't get no money from Bernie. What a great job, though, you know? What a great job. You know, benefits were great. No hospitalization, no nothing, but all the beer you could drink. And I never had to know what day it was because I lived right above the bar, and they just say, J.B., come to work. And, you know, you go to work, damn it's dead. I'm ready. Yeah, not a lot of training there, is it? So things just, you know, just really spiraled out of control. So I figured I needed some help. I didn't know what was going on. So I do the next thing that, you know, a good drunkard will do. I went ahead and I got married. You know, I wasn't doing nothing else. I didn't have a job. Is that crazy or what? What kind of woman marries a guy who's drunk and doesn't have a job? She's sad, man. She said that she had an idea that something was up. See, we just talked on the phone and saw each other on the weekends. She said, I just thought you drank on the weekends, baby. And I said, well, I never, you know, denied it. But we went to a natural bridge for our honeymoon. High-dollar place, I'm telling you. She said she had an idea that maybe something was wrong on the honeymoon night when I filled the bathtub up with ice and beer. You don't need that bathtub, baby. We need that for important stuff. And that journey began with that girl into, you know, every you know, we laugh in this room a lot, and we laugh in these rooms a lot. But in the early bird meeting, I think it was Blake said, my name's Blake, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's the second time I've ever said that. And just for a split second, it was extremely quiet in that room. And then everybody started laughing. And I believe it's that gallows laughter, because there's not a man in this room who real quick doesn't forget or who can go right back to the second time you ever said, my name's J.P. and I'm an alcoholic. And that's a big deal. You know, yeah, we're going to say it a bunch of times, but go back to the time you said it for the first time or the second time. That's a big deal. That didn't happen early on in my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll get to that in a minute. But started, you know, four months, I was, we got married and I didn't work. Just didn't work. You know, got a little money for wedding presents and lived off that. Cindy never asked me, like, you know, normal people, they get back from their honeymoon. It's like, well, got to go to work, honey. And, you know, it's like, get up at 1, you know, check out the soap operas, you know, just watch a few of them, then run on down to the beer joint. You know, that was my day. Her family started coming and staying with us from time to time. And Cindy would say, you know, they think you have, maybe a job. I said, where'd they get that idea? I don't have one. We have a friend, Frazier. He's like that guy on the Holiday Inn commercials, you know. I want an upgrade. I want points. that's it, Melvin. So anyway, my father-in-law was a supervisor for Norfolk and Western Railroad, the B&B, Bridge and Building Structural Steelwork. And he came to me and had put me in his car, and he said, would you like a job? I said, well, sure. He said, do you like to paint? And I thought, I'm not really an artist, but... I said, yeah, I like to paint. And see, what I had done, the jobs I had before that, I was a salesman, and I was in real bad shape. I covered Virginia, West Virginia, Tennessee. I'd stay in motels and drink, and I wouldn't sell. You know, I had that job for 3 whole months. And I'd leave on Monday. I had a little expense account, and I'd cash a check, and I'd go to Tennessee and get a motel room and stay there for a week and drink. And the daggone thing happened in the 3rd month of that job. They fired me, you know, because... I thought the same thing, you know. So what? I'm not selling nothing. I'm having a good time. And the day before Thanksgiving, I got fired. And I went home and told my wife. And then so my father-in-law got me in that deal. And he goes, okay. He says, you need to go take a physical. And I was, man. I was in bad physical shape. Little bitty fella. I've been staying in motels, drinking his wife away. And so I go to Crewe, Virginia. Anybody know what Crewe, Virginia is? That's a shame, too. It's a little railroad town outside of Richmond, Virginia. And I go walking into this room, you know, and they give me a hard hat. And they give me these things for my pants. And they give me these big old gloves. And they take me in this room with a bunch of big old guys with names like Bubba, Bubba's evil twin brother, Billy Ray Bubba. And there's all these big guys. I'm like, what in the world is up with this? And they go, we're going to go down here and get in the truck and go to work. So I walk down the truck, and, you know, I'm not thinking. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous a thing that's called spiritual axioms. And a sponsor, I said, what's that? And he goes, that means an undeniable truth. And I found out about my first spiritual axiom. We're riding that truck, and I said, well, you know, where are we going? We going to a bridge. I said, oh. He said, are you afraid of heights? That's a spiritual axiom to me. Hell yeah, I'm afraid of heights. What the hell are you talking about? Well, we're going to work on a bridge. It's so high, they call it High Bridge. It's so tall that the birds fly underneath it. Like, check, please. And I was definitely afraid of heights. And it was painting a sign or something. This is a railroad trestle bridge. Farmville, Virginia, 135 feet up. And this is before the FRA had fall protection and all that stuff. And, I mean, we get to that bridge, it's like, whoa, man. And they had all these old-timey spiking malls and all this stuff. And I crawled my first day back and forth. They'd be out there spiking. I'd crawl out there on the bridge, hand them a spike, and I'd crawl back up, crawl back out, hand them a spike. And if I hadn't been the boss of Sun, they'd have fired me right then. Right then they'd have fired me. But I hung out that whole day. And we stay in camp cars. They put the wheel, you stay in the box car. They have 8 racks and no bathroom and a refrigerator. And that's what you do. And I remember we went back to the camp car that night and all the guys took off. And I asked somebody, I said, where is it? What's happening? Well, they got a place down here called the Red Line Inn. I said, I think I'll check it out. And so I walked. They wouldn't give me a ride. I walked to the Red Line Inn. You can't keep a drunk from getting some booze. So I went in there, and I just drank all night long, just hammered them back just as hard as I could. And also, I don't know, it was late. I don't know times either. And it was late. And I remember old Bubba was standing there. He come up with something. He goes, you know, for a little feller, you sure can drink. I said, yeah. And And I found my niche. I found what I was supposed to do. You know, I could drive sprites for 10 hours a day. You know, Pee Wee would lay out 5,000 on Trestle Bridge, and we'd do it. And then drink all day long, all night long. And that's what I did for a long, long time. In fact, I even moved from Roanoke, Virginia to that little railroad town called Crewe, Virginia, and bought me a 69 Chevrolet pickup truck. It was so many different colors, we called it the quilt. Oh, yeah, it's a nice ride. Shifter went out on the column, so me and my buddies took an 8-pound maul, cold chisel, and put a spark-o-matic shifter in the floor. You always had to park it on a hill, though. That's the only way you're getting that baby started. And I started, grew my hair real long, ponytail, got some drop-down earrings, a couple tattoos, and I was ready. You know, and those boys are, it's just crazy the things that you do with those boys, you know. And I love it when people say an Alcoholics Anonymous, well, I can't tell you if they're an alcoholic. Why not? And people who've never sat in an AA meeting will tell you, JP's an alcoholic. Come on. All of us go to hundreds of meetings a year, been sober for years. You can tell. Oh, yes, you can tell. JP standing in the 7-Eleven with wet pants. He's an alcoholic. All right, it's not that funny. So, you know, just a little bit about our lives. You know, Cindy and I did move to Crewe, and worked on it. It was about 400 people that lived there, and you know, the sad part of it is, you know, in the wintertime I was cut off every winter, and I would sell some things, and to supplement our income, And, you know, people talk about being nervous. You know, are you nervous going up? I was nervous. But you know what real nervous is when, you know, a dope deal goes kind of bad and you got a 12-gauge shotgun and no shells. But you're in your living room, by God. Those boys want their dope or their money. And that's nervous. So we lived there, and I stayed drunk all the time. And I got to tell, every once in a great while, we get sent to places where they had to put you in a motel. And they hate putting railroaders in a motel. They don't want you in there, you know. And I remember one night, they put us in a motel. And I'm the kind of drunk that when I get to drinking, when it's time to, I thought you were going to say 5 minutes. Sorry, Rob. They were going to put us in a motel. The beds were like this. And you know, you open the door. And when I'm drunk, when it's time for me to sit down, it's just I pointed my head towards the wall, and that's where I fell. That's just the way I did it. Well, I remember, and people make fun of drunks, you know. And we laugh in here, so it's like your family. You can laugh at your family, but you don't like other people doing it. And they laughed at me a lot, and made fun of me, and it was sad. But I remember opening that door, and Big Wiley was sitting on his bed, just laughing at me and laughing. And I saw the wall over there, so I pointed my head that way, and bam, hit the wall and started down. And you know, just as it was over, you know, the last thing I saw was old Big Wiley just laughing at me, laughing. And next morning I woke up, and man, he was sitting on the side of his bed, and he was hot. He was hot. And he asked me another stupid question that they always ask alcoholics. You know what you did last night?
No, not since 1976.
And I said, no, Big Wiley, what happened? Yeah, well, I was asleep. And he said, you know how it is. You know how it is when you can tell somebody staring at you? Huh? I said, yeah. He said, I woke up and you were standing over me and you was peeing on me. Are y'all finished? Now, I can tell that and laugh, and you can laugh at that, but I'm here to tell you, Big Wally still don't think that's a damn bit funny. Oh, no. Oh, no, not Big Wally, baby. And we laugh about that, but y'all know something else. That's happened to a lot. I've heard y'all's story, too, so don't do it. Normal people, don't know the fear, the remorse, the sadness, the hideous horsemen that visit every one of us after something like that happened. Because, see, after that happened and countless other things like that happened, we have tool cars that are connected to our cars where we keep tools. And at night, I'd go down there one time, and I cut me a 6-inch piece of nylon rope. And I kept it by my bed, because when it came time to go to bed, I'd tie one piece to my left ankle and tie my other to the rack. And I'd tie myself down like a dog. And see, by the grace of God and people like you, I don't have to do that today. I'm a free man, and I can come and go as I please, and I thank you for that. That's a big deal in my life. You know, if I whip my pants today, it's because I want to. I got choices today, baby. You know, I'm also a nosy drunk. I'm a traveling drunk. You know how when you get real, real drunk, and I'm going to get sober in a minute, I promise. You know how when you get real drunk, you can't walk, but you think you can drive. I was always like, you give me the truck, my guy, we're going. And I can remember one time, it was 2:00 in the morning, and I was leaving a buddy of mine's house in the quilt, and I saw some lights. And I turned around. I said, I'll go check it out. It was a roadblock, road check. Oh, yeah, that's a smart move. Another time I left my buddy's house in the quilt, and the lights went off behind me. And y'all know, what do you do when the lights go off behind you? No, you don't do that in the quilt, son. No, you pull over. And I remember I'm the kind of drunk when I'm drinking and driving, I just throw down whatever's in the car. Just throw it down, pull it over, and opened up. But you never let them get back to your vehicle. You learn that early in drunk school. Oh, no, you get back there. So I opened up a door and fell out the truck. fell right in the middle of 40. And but you know, you always have eternal hope. The alcoholic is always hoping. It's like, we can do it. So I got up, dusted myself, and walked back to Benny's car. Benny's leaning against his car, unwrapping a pack of cigarettes. And Cindy will tell you, I was real bad about talking drunk. You know, she would just go, don't know what you said. You know, so I walked back and I said something to Benny, and then Benny looked at me, and I swear, because sometimes I'd hear drunk too, he said, ooda bada booda boo. Yeah, he was going past the point of no return. So I stopped him, I said it again, and he said, ooda bada booda boo, and I said, yeah, Benny, I'm drunk. Let's just knock it off. I'm drunk. Like he didn't know. And so then he gave me that ray of hope. He said, if I let you go to crew and another officer pulls you over, you promise you won't tell him? I promise, Benny. And he let me go. Then I upgraded from a quilt. I got a Ford F-100 with a camper shell. You know, motel room on wheels. And I remember it was the middle of August, and I was doing steel work then. You know, it's nice walking 6-inch steel, 90 feet high, you know, under the influence of alcohol and Valium. A lot of people want to work with you then. And I remember I had the F-100, and 460 traveled two lanes each way, east and west. And I told my foreman that morning, I said, Captain, I said, I'm really sick. And I said, I need to go home. He said, all right, boy. He said, get off, you know, just go. Go. And so I got my F-100, and I'm heading down 460, and just started drinking and doing the things we do. And, you know, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was heading east on 460. And I don't know why, but the state trooper was heading west on 460. And just as he's coming, you know, I've got the beer between my legs, and I just lift it right up, look at him, and go like this. And then, though, I'm real surprised when I look in the rearview mirror, and he makes a U-turn. And it's like, dog, man, what? And so I pull over, and I get ready to get out of the truck, and I get out, and the beer cans are just falling at your feet, and you're trying to kick them up on it. He said, just come on back in the car. But I had my insurance. Y'all used to carry it, too. It'd be that one Hall's Mentholyptus that had been washed 15 times. No wrapper on it, nothing but dirt and lint. And you pop that baby in your mouth, and nobody knows. It's like, I'm protected. You don't know nothing. You got nothing on me. But there were a few things, you know, my tags had run out. I didn't have a decal. I didn't have, and then he asked me the question we all know. How many drinks have you had? Three. You don't belong here. Two. Two. Medically impossible to blow a .29 on two beers. Couldn't do it. No, you can't. And he, so I blew it and I put the seatbelt on and I just, he said, no, because I'd tell him, the lies just come, you know how it is. And they just come and I'm telling them a bunch of them. And I said, I'm going to tell you right now, I can't say my ABCs. He said, why is that, Mr. McNally? I said, Officer Burton, I am dyslexic. You know, when you hear that stuff come out of your mouth, sometimes don't you just go, wow. I mean, no harm to anybody who's dyslexic here either, but he said, okay, he said, and I'd never heard of the one where they take the pen and you got to follow it. So he said, I'm going to take this pen, Mr. McNally. So I turn my back to him, and he says, I understand dyslexia, you have to face me.
There'll be no DUI today, baby, I own him. And,
we did the deal, and he said, Mr. McNally, do you have any friends you can call and come get you?
Yeah, my buddies are going to be real. They're going to dig that. I got a state trooper here once you come visit.
You know, that ain't happening. And I said, no. He said, well, you stand. They were having a pig picking. I get this. They have a pig picking. They have 25 kegs in this little town. They invite all the sheriffs, all state troopers, governor, whatever they have there, and then they wait outside the gate for everybody. There's got to be a law against that. It can't be right. And I stood by my truck. I walked down to the Giant, and I bought me a 12-pack and walked back to the truck and just stood there, for hours, drinking, watching him pull everybody else and giving them DUIs. And I don't know how long, a long time, but I heard him driving in that state trooper car late that night. He never even stopped on my truck. He hit the light there. Mayor McNally, you can go home now. Thank you. So, that's just the way my drinking was always like that. So then some other things happened. I had some kids along the line, and there just different things had happened. And Cindy came to me one time, and she said, there's something wrong, and we need to check it out. And I wasn't a part of any of that. And what happened was we were at the University of Virginia Hospital. I was in the middle of a drunk over. Y'all know that. You're half drunk, you're half hungover all the time. And I sat in a leather chair while a doctor took a razor and cut a piece of my little boy's arm for a test, and then sent us on back to the Ronald McDonald House. And, we went to the Ronald McDonald House and did the deal and came back the next morning. And we went and we sat in that room with that doctor again. And the doctor walked in, and he was just really hateful, He said, Mr. and Mrs. McNally, I'd just like you to know that your son has Hunter syndrome, and he'll be dead by the time he's 12 years old. Damn. And that's not what I said, I remember I was, in shock. And I handed Matthew to Cindy, and I walked out into the parking lot, and I looked up into the sky. And I said, I never really believed in you anyway, and you can forget about me. I don't need your help, I don't want your help, and I've never believed in you. And you can go, and I won't use the language I used. And I drank. That's what I do. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drunkard. And I drank. Y'all heard my story. I started at 12 years old. Can't blame it on everything. And just, there was just a series of operations and all this stuff that happened. I couldn't. I remember one time Matthew was operated on and I wasn't there, and his tear ducts had filled with blood, and he sat up in the bed and blood was running down his face, and Cindy was there alone. I wasn't there. See, because I was out drinking. They were going to operate on him one time, and they wanted to baptize him, and they found me, and they said, we're Catholic. I don't go a lot, but they said that, we want to baptize him tonight before we operate tomorrow in case things don't go well. And I don't even remember the call. And I showed up like 3 days later. Said, I don't remember. Cindy has gone through that from the day that I came into her life. I was never there. Never there. So then we came back home and had some more kids. And the disease that my boy, I have four kids. I got a bunch of kids. I got four now. And the male children born into our family have an 85% rate of having Hunter syndrome. And I now have Nicholas. He also has Hunter syndrome. I have a little girl, Stephanie, who is just, she is so cool. And, you know, that little girl, when I first got sober, Bob Burdett, who used to do the tape and was my sponsor, and he gave me, I had a bag full of tapes, you know, and Buffy was real little. And then after I got sober, she got in my truck one time and her foot hit that bag and she just jerked back. I said, "What's wrong, baby?" I said, "Just tapes in there." She said, "Daddy," she said, "that's the bag that you used to carry your gun in." See, that's the disease of alcoholism in my family, and I know it's the disease of alcoholism in your family. And, you know, by the grace of God, it's a big deal. That ain't my life today. And, you know, so we did some other things, and you know, I think I've been drunk long enough, you know. I want to talk about getting sober now, okay? I qualify to be here.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I qualify to be here. So I went to the beach with my family, stayed drunk, and I remember, you know, I had never heard, I don't know where I heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, you know, but I remember telling my mom, I said, "When we get home from the beach, I'm going to AA." I don't even know where that came from. I know AAA, you know, but I'm not, you know, I don't know about that. And I remember I told Cindy, I said, if we move from Crewe, Virginia back to Roanoke, will you quit drinking? And I was like, sure. You know, that ain't happening, but I moved. And so we got back to Roanoke and moved on August the 1st. And I remember, you know, a bunch of bad stuff went down. The deal about me choking her and beating her head and missing some stuff. And it was all over at the McNally house. And I remember, you know, I went to the phone book and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. I just looked it up. You know, and I went and I got me a towel or something and called it and put it over the phone and I said, "I got a friend who's real sick." How many times do you reckon that lady's heard that story? The greatest lie in the world, and you, that's the best you can do, JP. I was like, come on. And she said, yeah, there's a meeting up in Mount Regis, 8 o'clock. So I went up there, and I remember driving up to the AA meeting. I had no idea. I had an old truck, and I go driving up there, and I remember standing outside thinking, "What is this deal? I mean, what is it?" And I remember walking up these steps, and there were all these people in this room hooting and hollering, and just it was like, "What a bunch of damn yahoos!" You know. So I went to where the newcomer goes, back seat on the right. And just started rocking. Had my tank top on, my drop down earring, my ponytail, and just rocking. And then you start thinking, "Why ain't nobody saying hi to me?" You know, and then they started talking about toolboxes and pink clouds, and I'm like, "What? I was thinking of toolboxes. I mean, it made no sense to me." But see, during my drinking, one time I remember I went to see Cindy, and I had a bad habit of taking Valium while I drank a lot of alcohol. And that'll take you to places you never want to go before. And I remember I woke up on a Greyhound bus with a Wrangler jacket, Stroh's beer cans everywhere, and just woke up. And it was like, "Dog, where am I?" And so I did what we all do. You ask whoever's closest. I tapped that lady in front of me. I said, "Excuse me, ma'am, can you tell me where I am?" And you know that look, it's just like, ooh. No big deal, I want to know where I am. And she said, "You're in Washington, D.C. I live in Roanoke, Virginia. And so I walked in. I didn't have any money. I was going to see my soon-to-be wife. And I remember I got back. They validated my ticket. And I remember I got back on that bus, and I thought, you know, this will never happen to me again. Never happen. But then I had some new friends get on the bus. You know who the new friends are. They have liquor. And we sat in the back of the bus. And if it hadn't been for that bus driver waking me up that evening, I'd still be on that Greyhound bus, seeing the world. And things just, it was just that way. And I went to that meeting, and halfway through that meeting, there was an old guy talking. And he said something about passing out on a bus. And I was like, passing?
That sounds vaguely familiar.
But then they made me really, really hot. They made me really angry. Somebody said something about God. And I was like, ain't no way, Bubba. That ain't happening here. Then at the end of the meeting, they passed the basket and said, "So-and-so needs a sex change operation." And they just went crazy, hooting and hollering. And it was like, I wish I had my 12-gauge shotgun. I'd cut out some of this laughing. And then they wanted to hold hands and pray. And I was like, nope. And then some big black guy wanted to give me a hug. And I was like, hold up, baby. We don't play that at the McNally House. I didn't get a white chip. They left one on a thing up there. So, you know, they thought I was one of those guys that had to have a slip sign. So I just said, you need to have a slip sign? I said, no. And I was kind of hanging around. And they all, when they quit looking, I just took the chip, put it in my pocket, and took off running. And I don't care what any of y'all say. We watch people pick up white chips. We watch them pick them up. And I watch them. And after they go to all the other chips and nobody's watching them, you watch them. They reach into that pocket and they pull that chip out, and the tear starts to roll down their eye. And everybody in this room knows what that feels like. You know what it's like to pick up a white chip. Next week, I wrote a bad check for a big book. Asked me if I wanted one, and I said yes. Said I needed some money. I said, I got checks. And things were real bad at my house, so they announced that there was going to be a group conscience. And so I went home that first night. And, you know, I hated it because everybody in treatment there, their wives were hugging on them and patting them and rubbing their backs, you know. My house was locked up. My wife didn't want me home. My kids didn't want me home. So I go walking in the door, and I got that white chip in my pocket, and I said, I got a white chip, and there was dead silence. I said, there's a group conscience next week. And she said, what's that for? I said, that's for the really bad drunk. She said, make damn sure you go. And I did. And you know, that meeting, they had the meeting, the topic was on love. Everybody's loving everybody. Then at the group conscience, they thought about money. And I was like, dog, they was just loving each other. And now they, you know, so where I come from, I figured it'd be baseball bats and stuff like, and they just quit fighting. And I'd never seen that before. They just quit fighting and started praying and just forgot about all the fighting. And it was like, no, you know, when you fight with somebody, you get them. You might wait a while. Everything's cool. Your tires will be flat when you get out there, but it's all right. And so then I did the, you know, I started going to a lot of meetings. And for 3 months, I said, my name's JP and I'm visiting. Yeah, like you're on a cruise or something. You're visiting. And at the end of that month, I don't know how it happened or where it came from, but I said, my name's JP. I'm an alcoholic. And the guy said, thanks, next. I was like, wait a minute. Oh, this is a big thing here. And it's too late. He went on by. You know, he figured, you've been sitting here for 3 months. That's the best you can do. We're going on, son. And slow learner. And so, you know, 70 days, 80 days sober, I was downstairs in my basement at a pool table. And I was fighting the demons that we all know that we fight. And I was beating those balls back and forth. And Matthew had come down the stairs and he put something on the pool table. And I said, what's that, boy? He said, Daddy, since you quit drinking, I don't think I need to hide my wallet anymore. See, if I don't say nothing else to you people today, that's a gift you gave to me. And I stand here and I say thank you for that. I don't have to steal from my babies today. And I don't have to beat my wife today. And see, if you don't know that's a big deal, the people in this room know that that's a big deal. See, this is where I heard that. This is where I got sober. And it's a big deal. And my life started to change. Because, see, you know, then at 5 months sober, went ahead and elected myself president of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I see we have a few past presidents here.
Welcome.
And you know what presidents of AA do? You chair all the meetings at your home group. You chair last because you know the most. And you bring up the topic like the four step, and when you chair last, you tell everybody how easy it is. You leave out the important part, like, haven't done one yet. Don't worry, piece of cake. So, you know, rolled on and did that deal for a long time and didn't drink. And you know, I know what it's like to stay. I know two people say drink is not an option to me today. It is an option to me today. I have two options every day. I can recover or I can drink. Those are the only two things I know. And by the grace of God and you people, you gave me the second option. I stand here today and say thank you. And at 18 months sober, I walked out to my truck, and I said, if I had some money, I'd get drunk. And Bob Burdette took me aside. He said, you got any money? And he knows I'm always broke, you know. And I said, no. He said, give me a dollar. And I smoked then. The cigarettes were a buck, you know. He said, give me a dollar. They've been going to this thing called the Atlanta Men's Workshop. Oh, yeah, Ernie went, woo-doo-doo-doo-doo, you know. Came back to our home group. You got to hear these tapes. Got to hear these tapes. He wouldn't leave me alone with the damn tapes. I said, give me the damn tape. Threw them in the back of the truck, rode them around for a week, came back. They're great, Ernie. Never put the first one in. That's great, Ernie. Burdette said, you're going to Atlanta Men's Workshop. I said, I don't have any money. And I gave him a dollar. And so we got ready. I had a pigeon. And a lot of people hate that term pigeon. I talked somewhere one time. This woman came up to me after the meeting, and I mean, it was just like, smoke coming out of her ears. I hate that word, pigeon. I said, don't use it. I was Pollock. It ain't that hard for me. But I got what she meant. She wanted me to quit, and that ain't happening. We're riding down to the Atlanta Men's Workshop, and Burdette and my pigeon fought the whole way. I mean, just fought and raised hell and just, excuse me, and just, well, yeah, they raised hell. And I made up my mind, that I was going to drink when I got home. 18 months, and I made up my mind I was going to drink when I got home. Pulled up out here, and you know what all of y'all were doing, hugging, didn't anybody recognize me as president of Alcoholics Anonymous? I was a little upset about that. So the weekend started, and the Friday night speaker, you know. Man, when I sat in this room, it was like, man, I don't know what this gig is, but, man, there's something happening. You know, I don't know the deal. Late that Friday night, I went back to my cabin all alone, and I said, man, this is terrible. I got to go home. And then I thought, no, what I need is I need to help some sick alcoholic. So I came up here like 1 o'clock in the morning, and there were like 4 men back here, and one of them was Cliff L., who I didn't know from nothing. But it was obvious after listening to him for a minute, he didn't know what was really going on. And it was up to me to straighten him out. So I interrupted him. I stopped what they were saying and just lit into my brand of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know any better. And I mean, his eyes kind of glazed over for a minute, and I didn't know what was getting ready to happen. So I hit her and I took off running. So when I got all done, you know, I just laid back and thought, you know, did my arms. That's what you do when you really know your stuff. And it got real quiet for a second, and he said, boy, you full of shit, ain't you? Not that funny. It's obvious to me that y'all like him. You didn't realize I was a sensitive alcoholic. And in that minute, though, something in my mind said, stay or go. Stay or go. Stay or go. And Cliff Eld walked me around this place and held my hand and talked about the steps. That Saturday morning, my pigeon and I sat where we always sit, third row, 4 seat from the right. And magic and the power of the steps. First guy was Ron M., and he lit it up. And I leaned over to him and I said, I really feel sorry for the next guy that got out of the chair. Next guy was Jimmy S. Bang! I mean, that place is just... I said, I feel sorry for the poor yo-yo that's going third, and it was Bill R. And just about the time he finishes, I feel on my shoulder. I said, well, he said, we got to go outside, man. I said, all right, we go outside. He goes, you fired. That's not funny. Y'all laugh at all the wrong parts. Funny. I said, why? He said, because you don't ever talk about what those guys are talking about. You don't ever... I haven't heard any of that stuff. You know, what's up? So I said, well, I'll see you later. I don't need you anyway. And I went on down to the third step meeting, and it was Ron M. and a bunch of guys, and they at the end of the meeting, they did something called third step prayer, and so I got my pen, and I said, you know, how about jotting that down for me? I thought it was a reasonable request. It's a cute little prayer. Write it down. They did what all y'all did. Laugh like hell.
Ron Ram said it's in the book.
Oh, yeah, big deal.
So,
yeah, that was a great weekend, a lot of fun.
But when I was about 8 months sober, the only deal that I had done was Matthew came to me that morning. He said, "Daddy," he said, "I'm playing soccer today." And he said, "Will you go?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll go." And with his sickness, he's only about this tall and he's 18. And he can't walk. He can walk a little bit. He can't run. He's real stiff. And I sat out there at that soccer field. And every time he'd run by me, he'd go like this. And you know, I heard the birds chirping. And my stomach wasn't just rolling. I knew where I'd been the night before and what I'd done. And I looked at the sky and I said, "I don't know what you are or who you are, but I'll try." I know that's the second step coming in my life, and that'll keep me sober for a while. But Cliff L. said, "You can't stay sober on coffee and fried chicken. You better do the deal, son." And that's what happened. I sat up here on Sunday morning and listened to Neil Beam. I said, "Oh, my mind's a little gone." And I made a deal with the God of my understanding because I had my spiritual experience that day. And people say, "You can't make deals with God. He's mine, my will if I want him." Mean I can't make deals with God? I make them. I break them and I make them. And he laughs and he breaks them too. A little deal we got worked out here. So I sat here on Sunday morning and man, it was just unbelievable. Ernie and I, we stayed up all night Friday. I mean, maybe an hour. All night Saturday, maybe an hour of sleep. Rode home in Burdett's Fairmont. You know, he put naphtha or something. It was crazy. And was just on fire. For the first time since I was 12 years old, I felt at peace in my own skin. I didn't have to be something else. I didn't have to be somebody else. All that stuff was gone, man. And I remember I walked into my house at 9 o'clock that night, and Cindy was sitting on the sofa. And I said, "I need to talk to you." And she was reading the paper, and at that meeting, Jimmy S. or somebody had said, "If you've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months or more and your significant other hadn't told you what a tremendous difference they see in your life, you're not a participating member." And I thought, I didn't like it when he said it. And Cindy had just told me, "The only difference to you is you ain't drinking. The newness is wore off of that." So I sat down with her that night. And I said, "I need to tell you some things. Things are going to be different here." And I made amends to my wife. I said, "I'm never going to hit you again." I said, "I'm going to be with you and nobody else. Because I love you more than anything in the world. You're my baby and we're going to be together." And I looked at my wife and there were tears rolling down her face. And I stand here today to tell all of y'all thank you because you brought recovery to my home. And that's a big daggone deal to me. Next day we listened to Jimmy Smith's tape in our kitchen. That was the coolest. You know, I had to preface everything he said to her. "Listen to this part. Listen to this part. Man, let me play it back. Here comes the really good part." You know, I can't help it. I got to mess it up. And our lives started changing, baby, because we started doing the deal. And anytime I talk and anytime I share someplace, the Atlanta Men's Workshop is what I talk about. People in Roanoke will say, "You know, you can get sober without going to Atlanta Men's Workshop. You can stay sober without going to..." Well, yes, you can. Ain't it a shame? I guess there's a few people that agree with that theory. Every time when I come home from the Atlanta Men's Workshop, Cindy and I will lay in bed tonight and we will talk for hours. Okay, the truth is, I'll talk for a long time and she'll listen. It's like she knows so many of y'all. She'll ask about you. You know, "How's so-and-so doing? How's so-and-so doing?" Alcoholics Anonymous is in my home today because of the Atlanta Men's Workshop and my home group of men that share my life together. I came to my first Atlanta Men's Workshop on full scholarship. I came to my second Atlanta Men's Workshop on partial scholarship. When Bob Burdett died,
Bill S. called me at work and asked me if I would take his place on the scholarship committee. See, that's a big deal to me. I had a buck when I came here. A buck. Now I'm on that committee. Not president.
Yes, the committee, baby. But there, and it just,
and if people don't see what a great deal that is. We have a friend at home who talks about the God of his understanding put signs up every day. And you need to see them. I see those signs because y'all taught me how to do that. Y'all showed me how to do that. I stayed on camp cars for a long time, and I heard you got to take time to waste time with God. Set your clock an hour early and get up. So I started doing it. You know, I had my little, in my camp car, I had a weight room and all the, you know, and I'd get up at 5 o'clock and do my morning meditation, started building that relationship with the God of my understanding, and you hear Bubba and all of them come into work, thump, 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 and you hear them whispering about me.
What's that boy doing back there? I don't know, he's doing some of that yoga stuff or something. But leave him alone, he ain't drinking.
I've been sober for a while and different ones had heard some things, and I got in some trouble at work, you know, and I cussed the guy out and was going to hit him with a handle and, you know, some things that maybe aren't real sober. So I was on the back of the truck, and I have a hard time with the 10th step. I still do. I try hard. And I worked all day and we're throwing plates, and so at the end of the thing, I said, Bubba, he was on the ground working. I said, Bubba, hold up here, man, wait a minute. And I said, I got to. And old Barry goes, wait a minute, boys. He's in that AA thing. He got to say he's sorry now. A little bit of knowledge is a terrible thing. I said, yeah, Bubba, I'm sorry for wanting to hit you with an axe handle. And sorry I talked about your mama. I won't do it again. So. Oh, boy. Y'all are some sick people. You know, I remember Cindy, when she did the thing about Jewel, about, you know, ugly when you cry. One time I came here, you know, I always cry when they ask me, if they ask me to do something. And I always run and call Cindy, because she's my very best friend. And one time we were here, and they needed somebody to help with sex and sobriety, and they asked me, so I run right to the phone. Call her up. I said, guess what? They asked me to do help with the sex and sobriety thing. And dead silence, then she goes, you think they'd ask somebody who knows something about it? You know, I mean, I didn't think that was real funny. And again, it's all about you people taught me how to develop relationships with God, and that's what's happening. And in the deal I made with the God of my understanding in that row at the 17th Atlanta Men's Workshop, I said, I will never, ever miss the Atlanta Men's Workshop if you keep me sober. Unless it's, of course, for the death of Matthew or Nicholas, and then I won't be here. And I missed a workshop, but it wasn't for the death of a child, it was for the birth of a child. And Zachary Eli McNally was born. And let me tell you about the power of your God, the God of your understanding. My wife was 8.5 months pregnant, and we were laying in bed, and it was dark, and we were talking. And she said, J.P., have you talked to God today? And I said, well, baby, I said, you know I have. And she said, can you ask him if my baby's going to be sick? And I said, no, baby. I said, everything's going to be okay. And we went on. She had Zachary, and they sent the stuff off to be analyzed. And we knew it was going to be a while. Matthew and Nicholas are both, we're hearing aids, so it's always extra loud at my house. You can hear the TV down the street. You can hear them all talking down the street. And I went to hit a bucket of balls. Golf balls. Y'all are easy. And I came, and y'all, maybe if you have kids, they had that video, Andre the Seal.
And, you know, I came walking in the house, and, of course, I heard Andre the Seal down at the stop sign. And so I go walking in the house, and Cindy's sitting on the sofa, Matthews and Nicholson in front of the TV, just blaring away, and I see Cindy's crying. And I said, Matthew, I said, well, you know, what's up? He goes, she's been crying all night. I said, well, what's wrong, baby? She said they called from the University of North Carolina, and Zachary's not sick. And see, the deal is that the God of my understanding doesn't make sick kids, he doesn't make well kids, he just is, and those questions are removed from me today. And I stand here today to say thank you for that gift in my life. Thank you for that gift in my life. My daughter, my little daughter, who is just the coolest thing in the world, Stephanie, we moved to Salem, and I know y'all know what it's like here in Atlanta. Football's big in Salem, baby. We've won 3 state championships in 4 years. It's a big deal. Stephanie was little bitty, and then went trying out for cheerleading. And, you know, when I got there, you know, no big deal. They had the doors chain locked. 60 or whatever parents were there. And I thought, well, you know, what's the... They said, Mr. Manal, you don't understand. This is a big deal. And those doors opened up, and those little girls came out. I think, I got to tell my baby something, because I know she didn't make it. And here she comes out holding a little flower. She made the team. And I'm like going, you know, I'm moonwalking. You know, point at the little girls crying, no, no, no. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. A little bit. But she never said a word. She never said a word. And we got back to the van. I said, come on, baby. I said, what's up, man? What's this? She said, Daddy. She said, a lot of those little girls are my friends, and they didn't make it, and they don't feel good. And I submit to you, the man in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that little girl, 11 years old, knows more about living than I'll ever know. People who play golf with me have seen me make a 2-foot putt. I'm talking some trash. Came home from work not long ago, and Cindy said, and whenever there's big trouble in our house, she'll say, I got to talk to you. Walked into the house, in the bedroom, she said, Stephanie's pregnant. Stephanie's 17 years old, is going to be the head cheerleader senior year. And I left the house. I went to the Catholic church. Doors were locked. Sorry, Neil, they were locked. A little hot about that, I'll tell you. And because, see, when anger and rage fill me like that, a lot of times I only know one way to handle it. And I looked at my watch, and it was 5:30. And I drove to the New Hope group. And I walked in, I sat down, and I said, my name's J.P., I'm an alcoholic, and 15 minutes ago I found out my 17-year-old daughter's pregnant. And those people did what you people do. They loved me through it. Went home that night, she was afraid to come home, we got her home, and Cindy and I and her sat at our kitchen table and we cried. And we said, what are we going to do? I said, from this day forward, this baby will be a celebration of life. And she said, Daddy, what will we tell people? I said, baby, we'll tell them what they taught us in Alcoholics Anonymous. By God, we'll tell them the truth. December 31st, Dylan Patrick McNally came into this world. My middle name's Patrick. My baby named him after me. See, that's a big deal to me. That's a gift you people gave to me. And if I don't say thank you enough, I thank you, God, for that gift to me, that my daughter loves me. The girl who sees me used to tote a gun and do the things I did. She loves me. I leave my house, you say, I love you, Daddy. All of them do that. We all do that all the time. Thank you for bringing that to my home. Some other things happened, and I'm going to wrap this up. Matthew got real sick. And he had to have some tonsils taken out down in North Carolina. And Cindy called me. And it was going to be routine. Just routine. Next day she called me. She said, things have gone pretty bad. You need to get down here. And I drove down there, and they had him in a pediatric ICU. They had tubes in him everywhere, and they were telling us it was going to be okay. And we started staying at the Ronald McDonald House and staying in shifts. And it's a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous at a pediatric ICU. The family, you have one nurse for each two children, and the people, you got to come and go, and we all stay in the hall. And I watched death and sickness for 2 months. I watched little kids die. I watched families tore apart.
And I watched us answer the phones for each other. And I watched the people who were sick there become a family. And I remember standing there one time, and they were going to have to do a tracheostomy in the 10th day. I was trying to travel back and forth to go to work. And the nurse, I just got home 3 hours sitting at my desk, and the head charge nurse called me. And she said, "My wife is very stable." She said, "Mr. McNally, we just told Cindy that they're going to do a tracheostomy tomorrow." She took off running down the hall screaming. I said, "I'll be right there." So we got there. Matthew was on how many milligrams of fentanyl? He was paralyzed 6 days in a row, and went home to my sister-in-law's house. My family, when I was drinking, we used to live in a double-wide trailer. They had rats. That night, I stayed in a double-wide trailer and slept on the floor with my wife. Got up the next morning, rode to the hospital in silence with my wife, and walked into the ICU unit, and there was a new nurse at Matthew's at the foot of his bed, and she had her back to us. And she turned around, and I told Cindy, I said, "Look at her neck. She had an AA necklace on." I'd like to tell you she was a nice old lady, but she's a hateful old bad. She'd been sober 13 years. She said, "Son, you need to buck up. They need you now." I'm like, "Damn, hook me up a little bit here. A little sympathy, a little pity." Oh, hell no. He almost died 3 times on the table. Surgeon told us that she thought it was his time. My men's group brought money to us. They brought food to our house. And they took care of us. Because that's what people in Alcoholics Anonymous do. It's a big deal. It's a big, big deal. And if you ain't never found yourself standing in the food line and grinning at a can of peas, and you don't know about it. But you people do. I remember one time I just got off the phone with my sponsor. He just finished chewing my butt. And I was standing in the food line thinking, "Ain't it great to have a sponsor? Just grinning at a can of peas." You know, and the kid's like, "Are you okay, sir?" It's like, "Oh, yeah, everything's cool." And, you know, it's like the non-AA people, the old lady in the line, you know, we're all happy now and we're doing the deal. And this old, nasty, draw-it-up lady, she's like, you know, she takes my money. She wants to embarrass me in front of everybody. She's like, "Oh, God, are you always like this?" And the people behind me start laughing. And I think to myself, "No, I used to beat and rob little old ladies like you." That's not true. I didn't. I thought it. And so anyway, that deal started happening. And it was just such a tremendous... just the way, I mean, if you suit up and show up, these people are going to love you, man. They're going to do the deal. They're going to lead you. Family was there. Her 16-year-old boy had suffered a heart attack in a paint shop. And he was dying. And I had to walk through their family twice that morning, go in the elevator, and for the first time in my sobriety, I was angry with God. And I stood at that elevator and I said, "What is the deal? What is going on here? I have had enough. I'm tired of people dying. I'm tired of people crying." And I got in the elevator because the little boy, that 16-year-old boy, died. And I walked over to the Ronald McDonald House. And there when the child dies, it's a slow progression when they take everything out. And as the father walked by me, he had that look of just complete shock and desperation. And as the mama walked by me, she got by me and I heard her. She stopped and she touched me on the shoulder. And she said, "JP," she said, "I hope Matthew's going to be okay." See, I know that was the hand of God. My God put skin on. And that's what he did. That's how he let me know that a woman who had just lost her son reached out and touched me and said, "I hope things are going to be okay." There's my sign for the day, and I'm glad you people taught me how to read it. Cool. The good news is that Matthew graduated. We got him home. It was a long ordeal, buddy. Feeding tubes, just he never thought he'd talk, and... He's about this tall. We had graduation at Salem High School. All these kids are smart kids, are going to London. They're going to prestigious colleges all over the world. Matthew's not going anywhere. And they called his name out, and he started across that stage. And everybody stood up and gave him a standing ovation. He's a little alcoholic, though. I asked him later. I said, how come you were halfway across the stage, you slowed down? He said, I heard him clapping, Daddy. You're going to get that boy a white chip, baby. All right, I'm going to wrap this baby up. The deal is, and I close my story the same way all the time. You know, not all the time. Yeah, Zachary is now 5 years old. And about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Cindy and I were sitting on the bed, door closed. And he just kicked the bedroom door in, kicked it in. He's standing in his underoos and he's going, like, damn, boy, what's up? And he said whatever he wanted to say because I spoiled him rotten. And Cindy said, do you see the difference? I said, what do you mean? She said, that's a little boy growing up in a home that knows no fear. Thank you for that. Thank you for giving that to my family. Matthew was a little boy, and the neighbors came across the street. And they were taking the wheels, the training wheels off his bicycle. And I said, what are y'all doing? They said, Mr. McNally, Matthew's going to ride his bike. And I said, y'all know he can't ride that bike. And see, two miracles happened that day. First one was a little boy who was never supposed to walk or use the bathroom rode a two-wheel bicycle and felt the earthly binds of his handicap leave him, and for just a minute he was a normal little boy. The second miracle was that there was a 32-year-old drunkard that was there to participate. Thank you for that. God, thank you for that. Billy B had asked me to share at Lewis Gale that night. And some things had happened, and Matthew was a Cub Scout then. They raced those cars, you know. He said, Daddy, he said, will you go? And I had that ponytail and drop down earrings and that tank top. And we went to the Cubs Boy Scout deal, and they said, Mr. McNally, would you like to be a judge? I said, I didn't like people who dressed like this. I said, yeah, I'd like to be a judge. And but it was cool. I got to judging them cars and see Matthew fell. Because he's like us. We have a physical compulsion, the mental obsession preceded by the mental twist of the first drink. Our bodies react differently to alcohol. That's Matthew's deal, too. His body just works different. He can't help it, neither could we. And he fell and he hit his head and he was embarrassed because he fell in front of everybody. And he said, Daddy, I just want to go home. And you and I know how that feels. We just want to go home. So I took him home that night. My disease talks to me. And I was washing clothes and I laid him down. And I was down in my basement and I heard the disease of alcoholism clearly in my mind. Just how happy are you going to be when you bury that little boy? How happy are you going to be in AA? I did what you people told me to do. I went up in my kitchen and got on my knees. And said, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I felt His power in my heart. Thank you for that. Thank you for giving that to me. And I went home that night and I shared that with them. And everything was okay. When I go home, my kids, anytime, anywhere, just Nicholas especially when he was little, he'd just throw whatever he was eating or drinking and just take off running. And jump up in my arms and with that little curved hand just start patting me on the back. And that's what happens when I come to the Atlanta Men's Workshop. See, I get me a cup of coffee and some donuts and share with a lot of people and they share it with me. Because see, here it's different. I feel the arms and the hands and the people of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous reach out and hold me and tell me. In here, we don't speak with this. It's with this. We speak the language of the heart. And if you listen real careful, I can hear it all the time. It says, JP, we understand. It's going to be okay. You never have to be alone. 2 months ago, I had to take Matthew to the rehabilitation center. All the times I was never there for the operations. We walked into this big room. There's a little girl with no hands. She's been burned. All these severely handicapped people. Zachary sits next down to her, his eyes are that big. Matthew sits next down to him, his eyes are that big. Cindy sits down and tears are just running down her face. And I turn around, I look out the window and I said, I want to be here for my family, God. What do I do? And I turned around and I saw 300 men standing in a circle around yellow chairs. It said, I don't have to be alone. And I looked at my wife and I smiled and I said, baby, we're going to be okay. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. That's a gift that I can never repay. I feel the arms and the hands of you people reach out and hold me, and you tell me, JP, everything's going to be okay. We love you. And you never, ever have to be alone again. Thank you for that. You gave me something I never thought I'd have at 12 years old. You gave me, and I love you for that.
Thank you.